I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at you, of course I didn't.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello, and welcome back to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. I'm your host, material scientist Anna Pajaisky, and this episode I'm talking to Sam Underwood about his experience making modular mechanical musical instruments. I started by asking Sam, how on earth you become a modular mechanical musical instrument maker?
My father was quite into handmaking stuff, and my grandfather definitely was, so... We were always bodging various things when I was younger, including, you know, anything from stuff in the house to then fixing my van up when that broke down and stuff like that. So I've got a lot of fond memories of just fixing and tinkering. Mm. I didn't do much in the way of formal making in my childhood, really. I collaborated on some projects, I suppose, with friends, just... But they weren't really to any great end. They were just a bit of fun. And then I always had this... I've got this fairly strong sense that you shouldn't chuck stuff away if you can avoid it. So that's driven a lot of my making over the years. I've always just kind of wanted to open things up and make sure that I can fix them rather than chuck them away or find someone who can fix them even. And... Mm. Through that you make interesting contacts, and and then I got into more formal making really on my own in my spare time. So I always made music all my childhood and right up until present day, and I used to make computer music mainly, so I did a lot of synth building and stuff like that, because I got to the point where either the synths I wanted were too expensive, or maybe they didn't quite have the aesthetic that I wanted, so I was building my own bits from scratch. But to be honest, I find electronics quite hard, and I spent quite a long time trying to get good at it, and I knew what I wanted a lot of the synths I was making to do, but I didn't often know how to make them do that. So...
Sure.
So at some point I started to just build acoustic instruments, because although there's a lot that I've learned over the years on that, it is initially quite immediate. And I now build mainly mechanical musical instruments, and that definitely is kind of a system that you can see and understand in real time, and if you want to change it, you can hammer another bit onto it if you want, and it will do something different. And there's nothing that's hidden away in electronics that you know, so it's all just on view and you're able to adapt it to your means. So
I totally know what you mean about the electronics thing. It's always been a bit of a mystery to me how these things work. Whereas, as you say, like the mechanical side, the acoustic side, it makes intuitive sense, you know, how these objects resonate and how they create sound.
It responds very well to experimental practice as well, which is generally how I work. So you know, it is tricky, I find, with electronics to experiment in that direct way.
Whereas
building acoustic instruments, you can just change something and see what the effect is, hear the effect, and then move on from there. So it's that sort of stepwise experimentation which I like about it.
Yeah, awesome. So what is a mechanical instrument then? What are we talking about here?
Actually, most of the instruments I make are both mechanical and modular and acoustics. So I try to build instruments that perform across a number of roles, really, in what might be something like a fairground organ, I suppose, is a fairly commonly known mechanical musical instrument. But in a fairground organ, where there's quite a lot of similarities with what I make, it's all locked away. No one can perform the instrument, really, other than feeding in a paper roll, and it'll faithfully play what's on the paper roll. I have all of the elements of the kind of multi-instrument, if you like, out on show. And so when playing live, there's quite a visual spectacle as well. But it also allows me as the performer to be part of the machine and adapt what sounds come out of it at any given point. So it becomes quite a responsive mechanical musical instrument. But it is otherwise, largely as you'd imagine, it is some kind of drive system, which can be, on one of the instruments it is literally a drive shaft that runs, uses a motor that's out of a treadmill for variable speed.
Cool.
And then a series of large mechanical instruments that are kind of pressed against the drive shaft. Or it can be roboticized stuff. And again, there's an issue there with the electronics, and I tend to collaborate with other people for that side.
Sure.
But they are then all acoustic and modular and mechanical in that, that way.
Yeah. So how many of these instruments have you made?
I've actually made two substantial ones for myself. So it's two systems for myself. And then a lot of my work as a musical instrument designer inevitably is led by what commissions I get. So some of those are more in the mechanical modular realm. And often they are a small part of a mechanical system. So I might, for example, at the moment I'm doing something for a workshop where kids can attach things, little musical sounders and stuff that they've made to a system and then play this system. And as the system rotates, all of the things come into motion and they're sort of sequenced by the system. So, yeah, the answer is that in terms of fully fledged mechanical musical instrument systems, I've made two, and they are for myself. But the nice thing about them is they're kind of an endless, but either one is an endless project. And because they're modular, you never get bored. You can concentrate on the drums for a bit if you fancy, or then swap over to the organ bit or whatever it is. And you have this option to, which is very important to me in my own work, because I'm not someone who can really handle, I don't know, making 256 widgets day in, day out, which some people thrive on, but that's not really for me.
Interesting. I want to pick you up on your use of the word system. I'm really interested in that. That's quite, the way I think of system is quite a kind of engineering concept. Why do you call these things systems?
There are certain things that you set up when designing these instruments, which are decided at a systems level, really. So you're having to commit to a way of doing certain things from the outset, which sometimes further down the line can be a bit of a pain. There is that element always with them, that there is a systems level. There's There's also other decisions you make that are really fundamental to how it can work. Things like the overall scale is really central, obviously, because I'm currently making a fairly smallish modular mechanical musical instrument, and bass is something that's quite hard to come by when you build stuff small. Yeah. So those are all the sorts of systems considerations that I think are built in for, you know, at a very early stage in terms of how you design the basis of it.
Yeah, yeah. Would you be able to send me some audio tracks of these systems at play?
Sure.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd love to be able to play them to the listeners. Get your inspiration from for these instruments?
That's an interesting question. I like a lot of that sort of music myself. Mm-hmm. So I listen to quite a lot of mechanical music, and I'm inspired certainly by a lot of makers who make similar stuff, but obviously it is relatively small field. Live, I particularly like them because there is that spectacle. So I've always, even when I made purely electronic music, I was always very keen that there was a visual spectacle, that everything I was doing, in fact, was fairly on show.
Yeah.
So that is inevitable with the instruments that I make now. Mm. Especially with one of the larger ones that I've designed with a chap called Graham Dunning. And that is just, I mean, it's huge. And in the space, people surround this large, sprawling instrument, and they, you know, it gives a visual spectacle, an indication of everything that's going on. Everything is tied together. So I think really it is witnessing a lot of live performances over the years, some that have worked for me as an audience member and others that haven't, that has really driven me to frame my work the way I do.
Yeah, that makes sense. And how do you actually go about creating these things? You know, if someone comes to you with a commission, what's your thought process from having that first brief to then going about making it and finishing it?
Well, in terms of commissioned work, it's always a question of how much they want from me as a designer. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they will be musicians or composers themselves who have quite a strong sense of what they want the system to do, the machine to do. And in those cases, I'm led obviously by what they suggest, but they've come to me because I can hopefully add some further thinking to it and some expertise. And whatever the level of kind of doing stuff, there is always a phase of brainstorming and scribbling of ideas. There's a lot of stuff over I guess I've been doing this for about 12 years now, full time. So there's a reasonable amount of learning that, has come out of that, and so there's quite a lot of stuff I have an intuition for that I've either done before or have a sense will work. And it's really a kind of, I blow it out the water initially to allow myself to think about ideas that, you know, could come from anywhere.
Yeah.
And I even use some occasionally if it's a commission that I'm finding quite hard to interpret or whatever, I might use some techniques for thinking about ideas that, you know, just quite basic things like reframing what it is that they've asked for or whatever. Mm. But that helps me to think, you know, differently about the project. And then I draw that together through paper scribbles of some kind, often make prototypes, which can be out of cardboard or whatever.
Cool.
I mean, laser cut cardboard's not a bad way to make a fairly rudimentary mechanical system. So those sorts of things. And and then a series of physical prototypes. Mm-hmm. And that's really where my brain likes it most. So I like to have I actually quite struggle to visualize a system or a process when it's just on paper. Mm. As soon as I've got it in front of me and I can start to move it, I can go, okay, here's a way of adapting this to make it better. And, you know, so there is quite a long, often quite experimental phase then with the physical making side.
That sounds super fun.
It is.
I'm wondering if you can tell me about, you know, I love materials. I'd love to hear about any kind of, maybe some surprising things that you've discovered about materials in your adventures in making, or any mishaps.
Materials are obviously really central in terms of my work, and I'm always trying to work out how to do interesting things with materials for musical instrument purposes. Mm. It's very much an ongoing thing. It's a thing where at times, until fairly recently, I didn't have regular access to a laser cutter, for example. Okay. So I hadn't used various materials that I'm finding really fascinating, things like acetyl, for example, where you've got this really flexible, bouncy kind of springy plastic stuff, which can be used for all its acoustic properties, which, mm. you know, I guess that's not its primary use for most people. But for me, I'm interested in how I can cut it to make it make it kind of flex in certain interesting ways and vibrate in ways. And I would say actually that the way a material vibrates is almost always the most important thing to me. Mm. And there's a lot of intuition there. So when I mentioned the smaller instrument I'm making at the moment, which doesn't really do bass, I've spent quite a lot of time trying to get it to do bass. Mm. And that's led me to using latex as a sounding element. So where you would have a free reed in an instrument, normally it'd be made out of something like metal generally, like quite thin metal that vibrates. But you can, with latex, I found through the same process of lots of experimentation, I found you can make a reed that is obviously very soft and floppy, mm. but that means that it will go off at a much lower frequency than something of an equivalent size.
Right.
Because it just flaps kind of much slower. It's to go between its two states. So, it's those sorts of material investigations that I do all the time, really. And, I think one mishap that maybe that I've had is we had, me and a former colleague of mine, David Morton, we made something called the giant feedback organ, which was, as it sounds really, but it was a really nice commission. It was Southbank Centre. It was in the main room of the Southbank Centre for like 9 weeks or something for people to come and play it.
Yeah.
And it was these huge pipes, which had a speaker at one end and a microphone at the other and an amplifier basically. Mm-hmm. And the tube itself would create the frequency.
Yep.
And we were in charge of the very, very low frequency. So we were down at about 21.8 hertz. So quite low.
That's just the limit of human detection, right?
Correct, yeah. So that was our job. But then traditional organs actually go down quite a lot lower than that.
Do they?
Which is a weird phenomenon.
Huh. Why?
So... Wow, well, you might ask. there are theories. I think Sarah Anglis is somebody who's theorised about this in the past. She suggests, I think, that they go so low in order that they create a sense of another presence.
Whoa.
In a space. Because you can't hear it, but she did some tests back in the day with... something called infrasound cannons,
mm.
which are these, well, similar to what I was describing before, like a big tube but allow a speaker to go down into below 20 hertz.
Mm.
And she played audio to an audience with and without an infrasound channel, mm. essentially. And the way they described the experience afterwards was quite different,
no
based
way.
Just on, I mean, it was in tune and, you know, the yeah. bits that they were hearing, but it just was inaudible, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so her suggestion is that in a church organ, it makes sense to have something that creates a sense of awe and
mm.
otherness and so on. So I'm
That's
going
so
with that.
Cool.
That
That's really, really cool.
yeah. But yes, anyway, so the thing with the giant feedback organ that was a little bit of a problem in terms of the materials was that the pipes flexed loads, and we needed the pipes to be sensibly light.
Mm.
I mean, that at the time, at least, I wouldn't particularly, well, even, I mean, to this day, I wouldn't really want to transport things in huge trucks or whatever. So it was a case of it had to go on the top of my van, you know, and we had to be able to get it on the top of the van. So we had these fairly thin wall spiral ducting tubes, which you mm-hmm. will have seen in kind of air conditioning systems in big buildings and stuff. Mm. And we used those and they were fine, except they flexed a lot. And
okay.
that led to a system that's already quite hard to understand, because mm. feedback instruments are notoriously quite difficult to get to grips with, had another order of confusion, which was that the pipe was flexing crazily all the time as well. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So what did it end up sounding like? Did it just keep amplifying?
It's very loud. It's very loud. There was another really fascinating phenomenon as I'm sat in the same room as we built the thing,
mm.
Which was that we had these only three notes that we had to deliver, and one of them was this super low 21.8 hertz. And we found after a while that we just couldn't, despite all of the structure and size and everything seemingly being correct for 21.8 hertz, we couldn't get it to go down that low, and we didn't mm. know why. Until David suddenly thought, oh, maybe it's the size of the room. And we took it out in the garden and it immediately went down to 21.8 hertz because the room was constraining what frequency we could actually get out of the instrument.
That's so interesting.
Something called the room mode, I believe. So we did what's called a free field test, I think, which is where you take it out essentially into a field.
Yeah.
I mean, in our case, it literally was, which was funny. But yeah. So that was a strange phenomenon.
Mm.
But it sounded very low, very loud, and it was part of a series of instruments that were created. There were four instruments created.
Mm.
And they played in an ensemble with a load of school kids who sang in a choir along with it and stuff like that.
Wow.
And it was really fascinating, and it was really nice to hear our fairly limited instrument, really, in terms of number of notes or what it could do. I mean, it was on or off. It didn't even do any kind of dynamics. It was just on and off. But when in the context of the piece, it was really nice because suddenly it had this low end that you like with the church organ, which you could kind of feel throughout the whole space.
Yeah.
So yeah, it did its job well.
That's so awesome.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm going to ask you another nerdy materials and acoustics question.
Cool.
When I was writing the brass chapter of my book, I spoke to a trumpet maker called Andy Taylor, and he told me that he makes trumpets out of all sorts of different materials, not just brass as is traditional, but bronze and even sort of pure silver as well.
Mm-hmm.
I've always heard of brass as being what people describe as a sonorous material, i.e. well, I don't actually know what that means, only that like sonorous indicates that it's good at like making sounds. Can you tell me any more about, I suppose, material choices in instruments? What do you look for when you're looking for materials that are going to make or support sound?
A lot of the time it depends what part of the instrument you're talking about.
Right.
Because a sounding element itself, so the maybe the bit that you blow or or strike or whatever, is often quite distinct from the thing that it's then coupled to in order to make it amplify or or whatever. And really, this is a bit of a non-answer, but it differs so much from across the types of instrument.
Yeah.
So where you've spoken to a specialist trumpet maker, I am the opposite of a specialist trumpet maker, really. So I know a tiny bit or maybe even a moderate amount in some cases about making almost every type of instrument that you can make. And also I'm probably, I mean, he sounds like he may be quite interested in developing trumpet making, which a lot of traditional musical instrument makers, obviously they've spent a lifetime learning how to do stuff the right way, and they're not messing about with random new materials or ways of coupling things or whatever. But it is always in the end to do with how it vibrates and how it vibrates to the ends that you have in mind.
Okay.
And that is a mixture of the material itself, how you shape the material, and how you couple the material. And all of those things are really crucial.
Mm-hmm.
And in some instruments, historical instruments, they're even quite, there are deliberate things that people have done in order to make them sound the way they do, even though that's not considered maybe the correct way of doing it. So there's an instrument, for example, called a tromba marina, which is a large wooden instrument with a single string, and it sounds basically like a trumpet. It's weird.
What?
Yes, it sounds like a trumpet. And it sounds like a trumpet because it's got a bridge that the string goes over in the normal way that a string goes over a bridge. But the bridge doesn't touch on one side. It's a U-shaped bridge, and it hovers above the wooden body on the other side.
Okay.
So as it's bowed, the bridge rattles against the wood. And that gives it the kind of brassy harshness, if you like, to its tone. And, you know, you can tell the difference between it and a trumpet, but it's not far off. And yet it's a stringed wooden acoustic instrument. So, you know, so it's little techniques like that and how you structure and play with those kind of ways of either exciting things or coupling things. And, you know, that is really how I approach materials. It's not very much about a set way of doing things that's been passed down through generations or whatever.
Yeah. You've absolutely blown my mind there. I've always had a dream of making trumpets out of stupid materials. For example, ice, I think, would be really fun.
Wow.
Possibly jelly, I think, would also be fun. what's the weirdest material you've ever tried to use?
What's the weirdest material? That's a question I'm struggling with. I mean, I guess certainly latex is not a material I'm that familiar with people generally using in musical instrument design.
Yeah.
I guess I don't know if it's weird in the sense that you're asking, but there's something which I used not so long back, which is like a string material that's kind of rubberized string material, but it has metal in it.
Okay.
And little things like that can make a big difference to me, because that all of a sudden means that I can put a pickup on it if I want to.
Yeah.
So if I don't, in the case of what we were making at the time, I had this idea that I needed to be able to use a coil in order to drive the string so that it can kind of resonate on its own, creates a sort of drone thing like an e-bow does on a guitar or whatever. So that's funny little widget which allows you to sustain a string. But it needs to have metal in it to do that, and I also wanted it to be very low end for its size. So again, this is partly trying to get bass into this small system. And that is a very odd material, very odd kind of very new material. It took me a lot of looking and thinking to consider whether something like that existed. So I guess that's probably one of the stranger materials I've used.
That's really cool. What does your workshop look like? I'm trying to imagine what the workshop of a musical instrument maker would look like if you're making everything from things that toot to things that strum to things that crash.
Well, it looks almost exactly as you'd imagine, in that the walls are just covered with sets of things.
Mm-hmm.
So sets of different types of instruments. I've got stacks of shelves with drum cases on, and cymbals in another rack, a load of bits of sousaphone, a number of trumpets and trombone bits, a load of organ pipes, all sorts of things like that, bellows from various things and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then lots of random parts because of the way that I work. So there's lots of kind of plumbing material, for example, which I just need to be able to think of an idea and quickly go and get a couple of taps and an air system of some kind and clutch it all together and then see what the result is. All to do with a little bit what I was touching upon earlier, which is that my mind likes to work with physical making whenever it can, but also there's an element of trying to prove a thing or fail even as quickly as I can, because otherwise I get a bit bored and move on. Well, my mind's maybe thinking about the next idea before I've even tried out the previous one. So
is there anything that you're working on at the moment that you haven't quite cracked yet? I suppose I'm interested in, like, what are you struggling with at the moment? Any questions on your mind?
Definitely the flip side of making modular instruments is that whilst it keeps you with lots of interesting things to mull over and so on.
Mm.
It also gives you lots and lots of challenges that are kind of ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of always stuck on a number of things, and I just slowly work my way through them. And mostly I don't abandon them, but occasionally I do. But at the moment, I would say that, well, actually, it's a bit of an ongoing issue that I've had is to do with air systems for organs. So there is a very... I think it probably is because it falls more into your lifelong maker. It's a true craft skill, not one that I've got any training in, but I need to be able to do all of the things that an organ maker can do at times in order to build what I want to build. And I've never quite nailed a really good set of bellows with a... you have like two bellows that flip-flop to give you kind of constant air, and then a third bellows, which is like a chamber for that air to give you a constant pressure, and then that goes off to the various wind chests and so on. I've never really totally got... I've made bellows out of all sorts of stuff over the years, including an instrument with... large toilet plunger bellows that worked quite well, but that's not really the spirit of an organ, I suppose.
Sure.
So I think that's probably always been my biggest regret, I think, is not being able to fully get on top of that sort of a good quality air system that I can use across loads of things.
Mm-hmm. But that kind of brings me to what I wanted to ask you about next is where are you hoping to take this? You know, what are your hopes and dreams for the future? Are you building towards, you know, the biggest organ in the world, or the weirdest, most Frankensteinian musical instrument of all time?
It's a good question. One thing that's changing fairly soon is I'm starting a PhD.
Oh, cool.
And my PhD is on modular mechanical musical instruments.
Makes sense.
yes, and it's practice-based. Mm-hmm. So I'll be doing lots and lots of making of instruments, but also it gives me the first opportunity really in my life to spend a good amount of time on my own work.
Yeah.
And I think one of the main... things that, so I am quite wary, for example, I don't tour very much, for example. I don't play out very much. I'm quite wary of my impact on the world. I've already feel like making stuff is a luxury, really. I think a former me might have said that I wanted to make the biggest thing or the loudest thing, and to some extent I've done that, really. But I'm much more interested these days in low key but really hopefully quite enchanting live experiences, which of course missed even more over recent months. But my PhD does give, because it's at the conservatoire in Birmingham, it gives me the opportunity to perform with my own instruments, but also to get other musicians in to use my instruments and work out what they think's interesting about them. So I think really probably working on a body of work, some musical output from the machines that I've made. Because I think it's fair to say that I make a lot of instruments. I don't make a lot of music.
Sure.
And I'd kind of like to make more music, I think.
That's so awesome. Well, if you ever need to pick the brain of a nerdy musical material scientist, I can't promise I'll have the answers, but I'll probably know where to look.
Brilliant. Yeah, I'd love that. Thanks.
Awesome. Is there anything else you want to chat about before we finish up?
maybe I should, because I've touched upon it a couple of times, maybe I should mention a little bit more formally the couple of projects that I've referred to. So the project with Graham Dunning is called the Mammoth Beta Organ.
Okay.
And that's a large-scale modular mechanical musical instrument that is for two players to perform with. And it's kind of based around a mill-type approach.
Okay.
So you have a drive shaft, which we did originally think it might have huge slack belt kind of drive system, but in the end of that just felt too dangerous. It's quite dangerous as it is.
Brilliant.
But we've got a drive shaft, which then all of the modules couple to through friction, and then you bring in and out different sounds, and you kind of got a drum machine and all sorts of other things within the system that you can bring in. And then the more recent work, which is the project I'm taking into my PhD most prominently, is called AMS, and that's an acoustic modular system that is modular in the modular synth sense.
Okay.
So the format of AMS is the same format as modular synth modules, and they are controlled over CV and gate like a modular synth is.
Okay.
But all of the sound production is acoustic.
Ah.
So it's pretty wild. It's got things like, if you imagine a modular case, and out of the front of a modular case is a bellows.
Mm-hmm.
And that bellows is robotically controlled effectively.
Oh, okay.
So then unlike a normal bellows system where you're trying to provide a constant air flow and pressure, in this case, it can be kind of jerked around to create all sorts of strange parps and so on.
Yeah.
And that's an ongoing project which I've been working on with Richard Sewell, who I think you've had on before.
Yeah.
Because he does all the hardcore electronics that I can't face.
Sure.
So, yeah. But there's an album of stuff out soon. Of AMS stuff, and lots of it's a very rich area of exploration, partly because it does integrate with normal modular synth stuff as well. So I can have quite complex logic being done by other people's modules and just plug it straight into my modules.
That's so awesome. Do you have any gigs coming up where we can witness this live?
No, I'm afraid the answer to gigging at the moment is no, but that is a hangover of COVID, really.
Yeah.
So I've not quite got back on that horse yet.
Sure. Do you hope to be back on the horse soon?
Yeah, sure. I AMS is not quite ready to play live,
okay.
but there have been discussions about some Mammoth Beat organ gigs kind of early next year. Generally speaking, that is the aim in the end, is a live performance that people can experience, and hopefully it's kind of quite a novel experience as well as musically. I have to say the Mammoth Beat Organ is an acquired taste, I would say. In fact, most of my stuff is a fairly acquired taste musically. Because a lot of my work is in the experimental music realm, and audience numbers aren't necessarily huge, and we're into all of that, but it's maybe not everybody's cup of tea.
Sure.
Definitely planning to do more gigs, because that's where it all really comes to life and gives us the most pleasure, really.
Yeah, and it sounds like these systems and instruments are made to be seen and experienced. You said the word experience quite a lot, and it's a visual spectacle as much as it is an audio one, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely. And even to the extent that those are considerations when building them. So when I started building AMS, I had in mind a possible performance scenario for them. And, you know, I don't always get to the point where I've seen that through to its fullest extent. So things like maybe putting lights in them or stuff like that, or making it very overt. But they tend to be kind of quite obvious anyway. And you know, it's quite easy to see a kind of coupling between something that we do and the resultant sound.
So if listeners want to have a look at some of these instruments and kind of see what you're up to and keep up to date, where can they find you online?
Well, I've got a somewhat out of date website, which is Mr. Underwood, mrunderwood.co.uk, which will soon link to a PhD website that I've been building, and also a site that me and Miles, the intern, so I had an intern for 6 months who came to build wacky instruments with me, and we built a website together. So there's quite a few bits of work on there to see. As a result of this, I'll make sure they're linked up correctly.
Awesome. Thank you.
and then I tend to show my workings on Twitter a lot. So I will, it's really part of my process is to get to a point with a thing, do a little video of it, see what people think, and also hopefully get some inspiration from them sometimes. So I'm at Mr. Underwood, M-I-S-T-E-R Underwood on Twitter.
Fantastic. Oh, thanks so much for talking to me today. This is like the combination of two of my favourite things, music and making with materials. So it's been a real, real joy.
Cool. Yeah, likewise.
So that was the fantastic Sam Underwood on making modular mechanical musical instruments. A huge thanks to him for coming on the podcast. A reminder that my book, Handmade, A Scientist's Search for Meaning Through Making, is out now, available to order in hardback online and in all good bookshops, and available online as Kindle and audiobook versions too. Say hello to me on social media. I'm at Anna Pajewski, and say hello to the podcast on Twitter at Real Talk and on Instagram at Handmade Pod. It would be awesome, as always, if you would like to like and subscribe to us on all the usual podcasting apps. And if you would like to support the podcast with a one-time donation, you can do so at supporter.acast.com/handmade. A huge thanks to everyone who's already done so. It really does help to keep the podcast going. And a massive thank you, as always, to Alex Lathbridge for the music mix. Next week, I'll be talking to Steph Couturier about...
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Making stained glass. So until then, take very good care, and I'll speak to you next time on Handmade.